that I don't think are going to be met. I don't think he's going to balance the budget. And then things like, you know, reclaiming the Panama Canal, renaming the Gulf of, you know, Mexico. These are the accomplishments that he put out there. I thought he had some good moments, too. It was interesting, the children that he kept highlighting, the victims' families. And I'm glad that he got applause from Democrats when he mentioned the financial support for Ukraine. But again, this was, for me, this it didn't look presidential. It looked more like a campaign event. And it says that he's still probably in campaign mode, and he's not evolving to become the leader that the country needs, the true president for all.
Well, you mentioned the president talk about Ukraine. It seems that the president made news because he said that he has received a letter from Ukrainian President Zelensky, which indicates that maybe they are closer to signing an agreement to begin talking about peace. What do you think?
Well, I think that that was always going to be the likely outcome because Ukraine doesn't have any leverage. And it is sad that the United States, which is the remaining hegemon in our system, have to treat an ally like that. Essentially, they brought Zelensky in here to humiliate him, force him to essentially apologize. And this letter that has just come in, this is a last-ditch effort by Zelensky to salvage something out of the relationship. Otherwise, he's probably going to be pushed out by his own people, because they need the United States. There's no way Ukraine wins this war without American support. And Donald Trump knows that. But that's not how you treat your allies. You don't force your allies to beg you to come to their aid, because this fight in Ukraine is not just about Ukraine. It's about the entire Western world collective security system. And so if Ukraine falls, it affects the United States. It affects Europe. It affects a whole bunch of countries who depend on the U.S.-backed collective security system for survival. And so it was humiliating, but I saw this coming. I knew that Zelensky was going to be coming back with an apology and some kind of an olive branch. He probably should have handled himself a little better in the Oval Office as well. And so this was expected. Hopefully, now that Donald Trump has extracted this type of apology and humiliation from him, he lets it go and then realizes that supporting Ukraine in whatever negotiation happens is good for the world, and it's also good for the United States.
Okay, thank you, Professor. Professor Belt, I hope you're still on the line with us. He covered a lot of issues. It was, like I said, a long, long speech. It was nearly 2 hours long. It's probably a record. What stood out to you?
Yes. Well, I think it is a record for sure. I don't think we've ever had one that long, not even close. I think the longest one other than that was probably about an hour and 15. So he obviously had a lot he wanted to say, and he wanted to trumpet his accomplishments. There were a couple of things that stood out to me. His running down the list of how many people who are over 100 years old and receiving Social Security, this has been debunked by a number of different organizations, but this is him trying to show that there is a lot of fraud, waste, and abuse out there. And he talked about some of the grants coming out of USAID to try to turn around some of the public opinion about the moving fast and breaking things that we see Elon Musk doing. The other thing that is a little bit different than you see in most of these events is usually the presidents have what's called a heroes gallery, where they have people who they will point out and they will talk about, you know, the heroic things that they have done.
Right.
Whereas Donald Trump has more of a victims gallery, where he has people who are victims of men playing women's athletics, the Lake and Riley's family, a child with cancer who got, you know, a Secret Service appointment, and others as well. And this really helps to underscore his argument that the world that he inherited from Joe Biden, as he likes to say, is a very violent and dangerous place. He's going to change it into, as he said, the great liberation of America.
Anita's back with us. Anita Powell, our wonderful White House correspondent. Anita, that was quite a long speech. What did you take away from that speech?
That was a made-for-television State of the Union. Of course, it wasn't a State of the Union. It was a joint address to Congress. But that was a made-for-television event. You had everything. You had a lawmaker being ejected 7 minutes in. You had one kid getting into West Point. You had another child just mentioned with cancer who got a Secret Service badge. You had a beaming hostage. You had, and then at the end, you had Trump reminding everybody of his near miss with death and welcoming that victim's family. So it was a very, very evocative performance by Donald Trump. He hit on all of the points that he's made in his past 43 days in office. I did notice that he dug in a little bit on some of the executive orders he signed, calling for them to be codified into law. So this is showing, I think, how he intends to build a legislative agenda off the backs, perhaps, of these executive orders. For example, he called for a bill about transgender children and treatment. It's not clear what the content would be or which of the executive orders he's referring to that he wants this based off of, but that was one. He also called for a codification into law of a move against what he described as, and I want to quote this, illegal alien monsters. That was a very evocative description of what he was, of course, describing as people who've come to the United States without authorization. Illegal alien monsters.
Right. Illegal immigrants. I wrote that one down, too.
And the final thing that really stood out to me that was, can I just say, though, that kid getting the Secret Service badge,
it was kind of a sweet moment.
That was very sweet, the look on his face. And this is part of the magic of the State of the Union address.
Yeah.
These are ordinary Americans. So I just, you know, I just want to say,
and you
like
know,
that was
when
a...
you bring that up, Anita, it just makes me think that this guy is no one can take away from him the fact that he is a performer and he knows how to reach an audience.
But the other thing that really struck me that I didn't see on the guest list ahead of this was that Elon Musk would be in attendance in the gallery.
Okay.
And he recognized Elon Musk not once, but twice. And I thought that was very, very interesting. And that Elon Musk got more sustained applause from Trump than at any other point in his speech. You see Trump clapping for Elon Musk, whereas I don't think I noticed Trump clapping earlier in the speech. And then my personal favorite moment was where he was talking about waste, fraud, and abuse in government projects. And he mentioned one project in the tiny landlocked African country of Lesotho, which, if memory serves me, he said it correctly, Lesotho. And then he said, a place that nobody knows where that is. Mm-hmm. And I just loved that he apparently pronounced it correctly, but then said nobody knew where it is.
Nobody, yeah, a country nobody ever heard of before.
That I am pronouncing immaculately.
I wonder if Todd is still there. Todd, I wanted someone to talk about the president. He mentioned something about a gold car. Can someone explain that, please?
Yes, yes. This is sort of his immigration plus sort of idea, where he, the United States would take a certain amount of money from a person who wants to be U.S., working in the U.S. under a high-level visa, like a tech visa or something. Trump has previously explained it as being something that, like, maybe their company would pay for, or if they were wealthy, they could pay for it themselves. And it would be like having a green card, but it would have additional benefits. He hasn't really talked about what those were, other than maybe extending the amount of time that you can be here. But he sees it as a way of generating revenue for the U.S. Treasury to help pay for the other things that he'd like to do.
You know, I think it's important to point out, though, Professor Belt, that he's not the only president that does this. And at least he's proposing to do it. Other countries do this.
United States does this.
Oh,
yeah.
Okay.
You can buy EB-5 visa for a maximum investment of about $1 million and creation of 10 jobs will allow you long-term residence in the United States. This visa exists in some form in the United States. This is just a green card on with lots of miles and upgrades, I guess.
Anita, it seems that the president did not back down when it came to tariffs. And he says, if they tax us, we will tax them.
Yep.
Huh?
That's what he's been very consistent about in his first term, in his language about economic statecraft. He clearly does see economic statecraft as a key tool to managing our relationships with other countries.
You know, I got to say, I was at the RNC. I covered the RNC, Professor Belder, Professor Nwamah, you could jump in whenever you want. But I think we're going to the. I'm sorry. I'm going to cut myself off. We're going to go to the Democratic response. She just started.
In between, I worked at the White House under President Bush and President Obama, two very different leaders who both believed that America is exceptional. You can find that same sense of patriotism here in Wyandotte, Michigan, where I'm speaking from tonight. It's a working class town just south of Detroit. President Trump and I both won here in November. It might not seem like it, but plenty of places like this still exist across the United States. Places where people believe that if you work hard and play by the rules, you should do well and your kids should do better. It reminds me of how I grew up. My dad was a lifelong Republican, my mom a lifelong Democrat. But it was never a big deal because we had shared values that were bigger than any one party. We just went through another fraught election season. Americans made it clear that prices are too high and that the government needs to be more responsive to their needs. America wants change, but there's a responsible way to make change and a reckless way. And we can make that change without forgetting who we are as a country and as a democracy. So that's what I'm going to lay out tonight. Because whether you're from Wyandotte or Wichita, most Americans share three core beliefs. That the middle class is the engine of our country, that strong national security protects us from harm, and that our democracy, no matter how messy, is unparalleled and worth fighting for. Let's start with the economy. Michigan literally invented the middle class, the revolutionary idea that you could work at an auto plant and afford the car you were building. That's the American dream. And in order to expand and protect the middle class, we have to do a few basic things. We need to bring down the price of things we spend the most money on, groceries, housing, healthcare. We need to make more things in America with good-paying union jobs and bring our supply chains back home from places like China. We need to give American businesses the certainty they need to invest and create the jobs of the future. And we need a tax system that's fair for people who don't happen to make $1 billion. Look, the president talked a big game on the economy, but it's always important to read the fine print. So, do his plans actually help Americans get ahead? Not even close. President Trump is trying to deliver an unprecedented giveaway to his billionaire friends. He's on the hunt to find trillions of dollars to pass along to the wealthiest in America. And to do that, he's going to make you pay in every part of your life. Grocery and home prices are going up, not down, and he hasn't laid out a credible plan to deal with either of those. His tariffs on allies like Canada will raise prices on energy, lumber, and cars, and start a trade war that will hurt manufacturing and farmers. Your premiums and prescriptions will cost more because the math on his proposals doesn't work without going after your health care. Meanwhile, for those keeping score, the national debt is going up, not down. And if he's not careful, he could walk us right into a recession. And one more thing. In order to pay for his plan, he could very well come after your retirement, the Social Security, Medicare, and VA benefits you worked your whole life to earn. The president claims he won't, but Elon Musk just called Social Security the biggest Ponzi scheme of all time. While we're on the subject of Elon Musk, is there anyone in America who is comfortable with him and his gang of 20-year-olds using their own computer servers to poke through your tax returns, your health information, and your bank accounts? No oversight, no protections against cyber attack, no guardrails on what they do with your private data. We need a more efficient government. You want to cut waste? I'll help you do it. But change doesn't need to be chaotic or make us less safe. The mindless firing of people who work to protect our nuclear weapons, keep our planes from crashing, and conduct the research that finds the cure for cancer, only to rehire them 2 days later? No CEO in America could do that without being summarily fired. Okay, so we've talked about economic security. How about national security? Let's start with the border. As someone who spent my whole career protecting our homeland, every country deserves to know who and what is coming across its border. period. Democrats and Republicans should all be for that. But securing the border without actually fixing our broken immigration system is dealing with the symptom and not the disease. America is a nation of immigrants. We need a functional system keyed to the needs of our economy that allows vetted people to come and work here legally. So I look forward to the president's plan on that. Because here's the thing. Today's world is deeply interconnected. Migration, cyber threats, AI, environmental destruction, terrorism. One nation cannot face these issues alone. We need friends in all corners, and our safety depends on it. President Trump loves to say peace through strength. That's actually a line he stole from Ronald Reagan. But let me tell you, after the spectacle that just took place in the Oval Office last week, Reagan must be rolling in his grave. We all want an end to the war in Ukraine, but Reagan understood that true strength required America to combine our military and economic might with moral clarity. And that scene in the Oval Office wasn't just a bad episode of reality TV. It summed up Trump's whole approach to the world. He believes in cozying up to dictators like Vladimir Putin and kicking our friends like the Canadians in the teeth. He sees American leadership as merely a series of real estate transactions. As a Cold War kid, I'm thankful it was Reagan and not Trump in office in the 1980s. Trump would have lost us the Cold War. Donald Trump's actions suggest that in his heart, he doesn't believe we're an exceptional nation. He clearly doesn't think we should lead the world. Look, America is not perfect, but I stand with the majority of Americans who believe we are still exceptional, unparalleled. And I would rather have American leadership over Chinese or Russian leadership any day of the week. Because for generations, America has offered something better. Our security and our prosperity, yes, but our democracy, our very system of government, has been the aspiration of the world. And right now, it's at risk. It's at risk when the president decides you can pick and choose what rules you want to follow, when he ignores court orders and the Constitution itself, or when elected leaders stand by and just let it happen. But it's also at risk when the president pits Americans against each other, when he demonizes those who are different and tells certain people they shouldn't be included. Because America is not just a patch of land between two oceans. We are more than that. Generations have fought and died to secure the fundamental rights that define us. Those rights and the fight for them make us who we are. We're a nation of strivers, risk takers, innovators, and we are never satisfied. That is America's superpower. And look, I've lived and worked in many countries. I've seen democracies flicker out. I've seen what life is like when a government is rigged. You can't open a business without paying off a corrupt official. You can't criticize the guys in charge without getting a knock at the door in the middle of the night. So as much as we need to make our government more responsive to our lives today, don't for one moment fool yourself that democracy isn't precious and worth saving. But how do we actually do that? I know a lot of you have been asking that question. First, don't tune out. It's easy to be exhausted, but America needs you now more than ever. If previous generations had not fought for this democracy, where would we be today? Second, hold your elected officials, including me, accountable. Watch how they're voting. Go to town halls and demand they take action. That's as American as apple pie. Third, organize. Pick just one issue you're passionate about and engage. And doom scrolling doesn't count. Join a group that cares about your issue and act. And if you can't find one, start one. Some of the most important movements in our history have come from the bottle up. In closing, we all know that our country is going through something right now. We're not sure what the next day is going to hold, let alone the next decade. But this isn't the first time we've experienced significant and tumultuous change as a country. I'm a student of history, and we've gone through periods of political instability before. And ultimately, we've chosen to keep changing this country for the better. But every single time, we've only gotten through those moments because of two things: engaged citizens and principled leaders. Engaged citizens who do a little bit more than they're used to doing to fight for the things that they care about, and principled leaders who are ready to receive the ball and do something about it. So thank you tonight for caring about your country just by watching you qualify as engaged citizens. And I promise that I and my fellow Democrats will do everything in our power to be the principled leaders that you deserve. Good night, everyone.
That was Senator Elisa Slotkin from the Midwestern state of Michigan giving the Democratic Party's response to President Trump's speech. We still have Professor Nuama. Professor Nuama, what do you think? Do you think that the senator's speech gave any new directions for the Democrats during the coming months?
Well, I don't know if it's a new direction, but I think that she at least identified a target that is reachable, which is the middle class. And she showed them how many of the things that Trump is promising is actually going to hurt them economically. So tariffs, she was able to link the tariffs to the cost of energy going up, probably an increase in the national debt, was able to talk about how Elon Musk's work it threatens their privacy, and how Social Security itself might even be cut. She brought up a little bit something about Ukraine, reminding them of the moral clarity, the values that America cares about. You don't treat your allies badly, Canada, for example, and then reminded them that, you know, Trump himself talking about law and order, he's ignoring the law. And that's important message for the base. So the Democratic base was also important here. And she made references to the need for diversity, the need to protect democracy. And this is where she had the list of things that essentially the prescriptions for the base, you know, don't tune out and, you know, hold elected leaders accountable, organize. And so I thought it was a sensible list. I don't know whether it is enough. It's going to take them a while to find their voice. It's going to take them a while to figure out how to, you know, go at Trump. And a lot of it is going to be dependent on how Trump proceeds. So if we're still waiting for the fallout of the tariffs. So if it goes really bad, for example, Democrats probably don't have to do anything. They just have to wait for things to get really bad. There's an election next year, and that's probably what they're looking at. But I think that it's a good start. She comes across as a moderate from a state where Trump won, but she also won. And so that's the kind of the early Obama coalition. There is no blue America, there's no red America, it's just the United States of America. I thought that it was a sensible way to pitch it, but this is a start. We'll see what happens later.
Mm-hmm. Professor, thank you very much again for spending time with us. We do appreciate it very much.
Thanks for having me.
I'm afraid that's all we have time for, and thanks to our guest, Professor Kweku Nuama of the School of International Service at American University, Professor Todd Belt, Director of George Washington University School of Political Management, also our White House correspondent, Anita Powell, and to my co-host, Carol Van Dam. I'm James Bottis saying thank you for tuning to this special edition of Daybreak Africa's live coverage of President Donald Trump's address to the joint session of Congress. We'll be right back.
Since that time, DJ and his dad have been on a quest to make his dream come true, and DJ has been sworn in as an honorary law enforcement officer, actually a number of times. The police love him, the police departments love him. And tonight, DJ, we're going to do you the biggest honor of them all. I am asking our new Secret Service Director, Sean Curran, to officially make you an agent of the United States Secret Service. DJ's doctors believe his cancer likely came from a chemical he was exposed to when he was younger. Since 1975, rates of child cancer have increased by more than 40%. Reversing this trend is one of the top priorities for our new presidential commission to make America healthy again, chaired by our new Secretary of Health and Human Services, Robert F. Kennedy, Jr. With the name Kennedy, you would have thought everybody over here would have been cheering. How quickly they forget. Our goal is to get toxins out of our environment, poisons out of our food supply, and keep our children healthy and strong. As an example, not long ago, and you can't even believe these numbers, one in 10,000 children had autism. One in 10.